Our last speaker is Nelson Perry, and then we'll take questions, discussion.
Brother Abdul, Sister Aisha, brothers and sisters, comrades and friends all, I want to thank you for the opportunity to express our views on this very crucial question of black perspectives on the crisis of socialism. Before elaborating on this crisis from a black point of view, I would like to first define the problem this crisis presents to the African-American liberation movement. The Soviet Revolution of 1917 had an enormous impact on the bloody and deepening struggle of the African-Americans for their freedom and equality. At that time, despite the inter-imperialist wars for the control of the colonies, the white nations held the colored colonial eastern and southern sector of the world in an iron grip. The United States was emerging as the industrial and financial leader of these imperialist nations. The Soviet Revolution broke the seemingly impregnable ranks of world reaction, exploitation, and imperialism. An antagonism immediately developed between the United States and the newly organized world revolutionary movement led by the Soviet Union. The fundamental tactic of the revolutionary movement was to form a bloc with the colonial people as a way of defending itself against imperialist aggression. This tactic exacerbated the natural antagonism between socialism and imperialism. It also formed alliances and certain interdependence between the socialist revolution and the colored colonies. The revolutionary wave that created the Soviet Union swept around the world, creating conditions favorable to the consolidation of a political and ideological left wing of the black liberation movement in this country. This left wing quickly sensed the advantages of using the struggle between imperialism and socialism to appeal to the world, as well as having a base for both attack and defense. The rise of the Paul Robesons and W.E.B. Du Bois created a new level in the political internationalization of the struggle. Stalin's statement condemning the genocide against and repression of the African Americans was a high point in this motion. This was the first time a head of state had dared to challenge the American ideal of democratic rights. Thus, this polarity between the world revolution and the United States could and did weaken the political and ideological hegemony the American ruling class had maintained over the African Americans for some 300 years. As the left learned to appeal to and through the world revolutionary movement, the leadership of the African Americans began to openly to and through the world revolutionary movement, the leadership of the African Americans began to openly split. Some wanted real freedom, and some wanted a freedom movement so they could continue to be the well-paid, applauded, loyal spokespersons for the ruling class within that movement. This contradiction reached a high point with Congressman Adam Clayton Powell militantly defending the racial and imperialist policies of the United States and attacking communism at the historic Bandung Conference. On the other hand, Paul Robeson earned the undying hatred of the ruling class by declaring that the American blacks would never fight the Soviet Union. The specter of a mass black communist movement terrified the ruling class. Both the revolutionary movement and the left-of-center black leaders learned to use this fear. For example, during the prolonged peace talks at Panmunjom, Korea, an American general called his North Korean adversary savages. The North Korean general handed him a picture of black children trying to protect their school books while they were attacked by dogs, the four-legged kind, of the Alabama police force. This incident hurried the integration of the army and forced the government to take a few timid steps towards extending human rights to the blacks. The point is that the revolutionary movement and the socialist camp was an external base and to some degree a protection for the emergence of new and militant tactics. This basis, along with the consolidating Pan-African movement, focused a worldwide spotlight on the struggle of the African Americans for freedom. Things began to change in the 1950s with the emergence of a right-wing and counter-revolutionary force in the Soviet Union led by Nikita Khrushchev. These forces immediately sought accommodation with the United States. Malcolm very well understood the danger for the peoples of color throughout the world posed by this so-called détente. As a dialogue between the U.S. and the USSR warmed, Malcolm warned the colored world, quote, "the white folks are getting their heads together," close quotes. This simple statement contained three centuries of accumulated knowledge. During the days of slavery, the core of any political, social, or economic discussion by members of the ruling class had to be how were they to increase the physical control and economic exploitation of the slave. The slaves soon noted that the immediate aftermath of a meeting of whites was an increase in brutality against and exploitation of the blacks. The whisper in the slave pens that the white folks are getting their heads together was a serious political warning. At the time of Malcolm's statement, imperialism was white, and the colonies were colored. Therefore, there was nothing racist in this statement. It was Malcolm's typical, historically knowledgeable, gutsy reaction to social motion in the real world. That knowledge is summed up as this. Just as the African-American people are the social, economic, and political Achilles heel of United States imperialism, the colonies are the Achilles heels of world imperialism. The only way to overthrow imperialism, including American imperialism, is through the liberation of the colonies, because imperialism cannot live without colonies. Any help to the colonial revolution inevitably would aid the African-Americans, and conversely, any backing away from the struggle against world imperialism weakened the struggle of the African-Americans. The white folks getting their heads together meant an accommodation between natural enemies, imperialism and socialism. When natural enemies reach accommodation, it is at the expense of a third party. The loser was the colonial world, including the African-Americans. Thus we see that the very beginning of the political crisis within socialism had an effect upon the African-Americans. The more intense the crisis became, the more socialism withdrew from an alliance with the colonial world, and stronger became the hand of the right-wing direct agents of imperialism within the black liberation movement. It would be worthwhile for us to describe this crisis of socialism. What is a crisis? A crisis is a stage in a sequence of events which determine the trend of all future events. What is the basis of the crisis of this crisis stage of events? It is difficult to break into a historical process, but we shall try because clarity is indisputable to resolution of this problem. During the building industrial socialism in a semi-feudal, agricultural, economically backward country was an accomplishment of world historic significance. Two basically hostile forces had to at least temporarily unite to accomplish this. The main force, the masses of working people, had the will to sacrifice to accomplish this end. The other force, the intelligentsia, which was mainly from the former feudal and capitalist classes, had the technical knowledge of how to build an industrial society. They demanded and received privilege in exchange for their cooperation. From the very beginning, a deadly battle was underway between these two forces. The representatives of the people had to form an alliance with the struggling masses of the world in order to defend themselves. Thus, they were constantly at war with imperialism. The Soviet Union fought 20 defensive wars between 1920 and 1940, one of them against an invasion by the United States. On the other hand, the privileged strata had no interest in the welfare of the world's masses. Their interests lie in accumulating personal wealth. That could only be done through peace with imperialism, and that could only come if socialism abandoned the national liberation struggle, if it ceased to be socialism. This is the fundamental reason why the struggle inside socialism expressed itself as a struggle over policy regarding the United States. Revolution and counter-revolution are not subjective events. They cannot come about simply because someone wants it. A political revolution can only come about in the process of an economic revolution. A fundamental change in the means of production, in the economy, compels society to reorganize itself. During the instability of social disorganization and reorganization, political revolution, that is, the overthrow of one class by another, is possible. Thus, the Soviet Revolution came during the reorganization of society from agriculture to industry. This has been true for every socialist revolution thus far. We are again in a period of economic revolution, this time from electromechanics to electronics. A look at the streets of New York City, or any city, will convince anyone of the fact of social disorganization and the inevitability of social reorganization. Things are changing, and only a political revolution will guarantee that these changes are in the interest of our class and our people. The probability and striving of political revolution from the left and from the right are clear. From this overview, let us examine black perspectives of the crisis of socialism. Perhaps it would be well to rename it the tactics of the black liberation movement during the crisis of socialism. The first observation must be that the protection and propaganda base offered us by the international struggle between capitalism and socialism has at least been temporarily liquidated. There is, now, no external force to take its place. This has created favorable conditions for the right wing of the national liberation movement to seize control. The second is that simultaneously, the accelerating transformation from electromechanics to electronics is creating sharp economic and ideological struggle. Cutting the need for a large workforce necessarily means cuts in the maintenance of that force. The proletarian bloc, the most economically vulnerable section of the working class, has and is taking the brunt of change. As the economic crisis deepens, the whites and blacks in areas of economic equality are being urged towards a fratricidal struggle over jobs. This is the basis for the dangerous rise of fascist white nationalism. The black bourgeoisie is abandoning the black proletariat as the economic distance between them widens. In the recent Louisiana election, 5% of the blacks making over $30,000 voted for Duke. This small statistic shows a definite tendency that will become a trend. The conclusion is that we as a people are in danger. I do not believe that history repeats itself. Events occur as a spiral on an ever higher plane rather than a circle on the same plane. However, it is worthwhile to take note of the process of the first Reconstruction, its defeat, and the period of reaction that followed in relation to the period we find ourselves in today. At the end of the Civil War, the slave power had been militarily but not politically defeated. Their majority on the Supreme Court and the Senate, plus a sympathetic executive, threatened to politically snatch the military victory from the industrial North. They could not outvote, though, the slave power in the South without enfranchising the ex-slave, thus Reconstruction. By 1870, the plantation owners, politically defeated, became the loyal appendage of the industrial financial oligarchy arising in the North. This goal accomplished, Reconstruction ended. The North handed the defenseless blacks over to the enemy. Then came 80 years of lynching, merciless exploitation, and brutality that rivaled and often exceeded that of the racist regime of South Africa. The need for black labor and black soldiers during World War II eased conditions, but at the end of the war, there was a drive to force the blacks back to their pre-war status. During this period, a new grouping of international finance capitalists arose to challenge the political supremacy of the industrialists and their Dixiecrat allies. This new political grouping needed to industrialize the South and to take advantage of its docile labor force and its accessible resources. This could not be done without destroying the de jure segregation. The votes to destroy segregation depended upon re-enfranchising the blacks, thus the second round of Reconstruction. The Rankins, Tommages, and their ilk were bought to heel, united with and became loyal servants of finance capital. Today, electronic production with its minimal labor requirements is replacing electromechanical industry in the South as elsewhere. The need for black labor has diminished. Both the Democratic and Republican parties have let it be known that they have no need for black votes. The political left is in disarray. The black bourgeoisie has been thoroughly integrated into the general American bourgeoisie and has distanced itself from the black proletariat. The developing depression within the economic revolution has opened the door, and the ugly specter of fascism again emerges in the South. We are seeing the 1870 reaction to Reconstruction at a higher level. The African Americans are being tossed aside politically and economically as politically and economically superfluous. Comrades, these black masses are in danger. To meet that danger, it is first necessary to grasp the deep and fundamental changes taking place in this country. If these changes are understood, winning political tactics can be developed. The most fundamental expression of change is a shifting of emphasis from color to class. This shift was dependent upon the shifting of the black masses themselves from the countryside and the farm to the heart of the working class in the bigger cities. No matter how harsh the contradiction between black and white workers, it is not possible to have a black working class and a white working class. Economic and social segregation was possible in the sharecropping system because a sharecropper was a farm cooperative or farm operative, a businessman. It is not possible to attack the black worker without becoming entangled with the white, who is in the same economic category. Thus, we saw 44% of the poor whites of Louisiana voted against Duke, as did 99% of the poor blacks. The difficulty of politically separating black and white economic equals is the wooden link in this frightful, historically forged steel chain of American fascism. Uniting the whites as whites requires overcoming the internal class contradictions. This is the role of the racist propaganda. Shrewdly enough, this propaganda does not deal with the contradictions between whites. It attempts to isolate the blacks. They understand that the isolation of the blacks will mean the unity of the whites. Comrades and friends, we must prevent that unity. This is no longer a game we can choose to play or not play. The stakes are no longer a few jobs or of managing poverty are having a few black faces in the state consuls. The movement is absolutely correct in raising the charge of genocide. The rising gang of American fascists, and they are not all led by David Duke, have the goal of physically eliminating the unemployable, impoverished section of the working class. They have started with its black vanguard. Not possible? A year ago, I would not have thought it possible that a civilized country such as Brazil would hunt down and shoot homeless children because they are an eyesore and bother the tourists. Thus far, they have killed 2,000 of these children. Neither would I have believed that human slavery could ever again exist in the Soviet Union. In October of this year, a Moscow paper exposed that the luring and capture of thousands of people and their sale into slavery has been going on steadily since the late 1950s. And I quote from this newspaper, "We are talking about the most primitive kind of slavery known since primeval times. It is acquiring threatening dimensions in our country. Today's slave settlements are called family farms. Outsiders are forbidden to enter them, and the corrupt local authorities refer to them as a return to age-old national traditions." Close quotes. Yes, large-scale actual genocide is possible. It is the program of our enemy. We must lay aside any illusions and meet this danger head-on. The first point is to prevent our isolation. We can do this by fighting as our parents and their parents have fought. That is to deeply understand that our fight is not simply for us as African Americans. Our fight is in the cause of humanity. The public school system is to a great extent the result of the fight of the African Americans for education. It was won because it was for the children, and those who refused to join that fight stood exposed as against children, not simply against African Americans. This also applies to the gains in health care, housing, and labor legislation. The black worker, being the very heart of the most oppressed and exploited, cannot move except in the interest of the whole of the oppressed and exploited. Comrades, in order to win this fight, I believe we must make it clear that we understand that we are not simply an oppressed people they can isolate and destroy. We are also at the core of an exploited class they cannot destroy. Let us mobilize our oppressed peoples to demand housing for all who lack it. Let us mobilize our oppressed peoples to demand health care and food for all those in distress. This was a tactic of our forebears, and it must be ours. Malcolm clearly understood this and saw the necessity of our understanding it when he stated, "I believe there will be a clash between those who want freedom, justice, and equality for everyone and those who want to continue the system of exploitation." Malcolm was right. We will blunt and then defeat this rising fascist offensive because we fight not only for a nationality, but for a class. We will rally that class around us, and they will never defeat us. If there was ever a time and a people with a world to win and little to lose but their chains, it is here and now. The crisis of socialism is part of the general crisis that is forcing us to battle. Therefore, a black perspective to this crisis must be, let the new leaders step forward. Let the youth be inspired. Let the people be united. Let us all turn our face towards a new cooperative future with understanding and with determination. Thank you very much, comrades.